The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. We're going to hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 663. We have amendments to that bill that are now up to the dash 13s, which is a very technical update of the dash 12s. So we've got a long list of people to testify on this, the tobacco licensure bill. Mazen, do you have a brief update on what the 12s and 13s will do?
Mr. Chair, the 12th is basically sits the licensing procedures, regimes, if you will, and allows the Department of Revenue to set several processes by rule and also set the fee to cover the cost reasonably. And it allows also for inspections and enforcement. It gives the civil penalties. It specifies what penalties are by how long and how many occurrences of violations of I guess underage selling, and it allows for intergovernmental type of cooperation and agreements between departments, especially OHA and Department of Revenue, and just makes the operative date for the law to be, or for the bill to be, July 1st, 2017.
Okay, so to put this in perspective, Oregon is one of only 8 states without a tobacco licensure law. And we've seen studies this year, in fact, that show that one of the best tools to keep tobacco out of the hands of minors is licensure. So that's what we're working toward, trying to build consensus to. And it's been a pretty healthy discussion, I will say, which is one of the reasons we have so many of these drafts. So we're up to the 12s and now 13s. So we've got a lot of people signed up. I would like to start, if I could, with Lynn Saxton, the director of the Oregon Health Authority.
You notice, Mr. Chair, we keep moving up the tier until we finally get the director.
Welcome. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Saxton, director of the Oregon Health Authority, and with me this morning I have Tish Mack, who is our coordinator for the SINAR, federal SINAR program. Tobacco use remains the number one preventable cause of death and disease in Oregon, killing 7,000 people each year. It's a major risk factor for developing asthma, arthritis, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, tuberculosis, and ectopic pregnancy, as well as lung, liver, colorectal, and other forms of cancer. It also worsens symptoms for people already battling chronic diseases, and this burden falls hardest on lower-income Oregonians, and certain racial and ethnic communities use tobacco at higher rates and suffer the harshest consequences. Yet whether or not we use tobacco, all Oregonians pay the price. Medical expenses and lost wages that result from tobacco-related disease and premature death cost Oregon $2.5 billion per year, or $1,600 for every household in the state. This is 13.4% of the total Oregon Health Authority budget. If we are serious about saving taxpayer dollars within the healthcare budget in the future, this is our critical focal point. I want to talk about a couple things today. I want to talk about why kids start smoking and what works for regulating and preventing that activity, and where the Oregon Health Authority wants to go in terms of successfully addressing this significant challenge. Tobacco is cheap, it's easily accessible to youth, it's heavily promoted and marketed in retail outlets near the places where kids hang out. It's also considered glamorous. In 2012, the Surgeon General report stated that tobacco companies, quote, tobacco companies spend approximately 90% of their marketing dollars on point-of-sale promotion and price discounts. They invest billions at the point of sale because they know that their marketing pays off in the form of new young customers who, because of the powerful addictive properties of nicotine, are likely to be lifelong tobacco users. The Surgeon General's report makes it clear that tobacco marketing, and marketing at the point of sale in particular, is increasing youth tobacco use rates. Parental influence is very critical. Parental use of tobacco, supervision, and communication about the impacts of tobacco are significant factors as to whether a young person will take up this deadly habit. And this is supported by survey data from the Department of Human Services, U.S. Department of Human Services, and the Centers for Disease Control. We know what works. Addiction to nicotine starts in adolescence. 9 out of 10 adults who smoke started smoking before turning 18. Higher levels of tobacco marketing at the retail space, lower tobacco prices, an assortment of flavors, and greater availability of tobacco coupons and promotions are associated with product uptake among middle and high school students. Thus, policies need to focus on these retail locations, effectively reducing the amount and impact of tobacco marketing at the point of sale and prevent youth from initiating tobacco use. Tobacco licensure is a system to enforce sales to minors laws, as well as prevention policies that have a meaningful impact on youth use of tobacco. When used to enforce effective policies, licensing can reduce the number of Oregon children and young adults that become addicted to tobacco, help current tobacco users quit, and reduce health care costs for the state of Oregon. A retail licensure that includes the following core components creates a straightforward method for identifying businesses that sell tobacco products and managing enforcement of tobacco laws, such as sales to minors. The elements include a license fee, compliance inspections, graduated penalty for the outlet or retailer, no preemption that restricts local governments from enacting stronger tailored policies, inclusion of inhalant delivery systems in the Indoor Clean Air Act provisions, and banning of all product sampling. Currently, 38 states and the District of Columbia require retailer licensure for over-the-counter tobacco sales. Of the states that do not require retail licensing, 9 of them ranked among the top 20 for retailer violation rates for sales of tobacco to a minor during the fiscal year 2013. Where do we want to go? Tobacco is the number one cost driver, again, for our healthcare system. If we want to continue to bend the cost curve in Oregon to save billions of taxpayer dollars, as we are currently doing, we have to implement proven practices and be aggressive in our regulation and enforcement. Senate Bill 663A includes some core licensing components, and my team tells me this morning that the Dash 13 amendments include technical revisions that support effective enforcement. But we need to be sure that we are not too key things we need to be sure that we're not providing exemptions for inhalant delivery systems, and finally, that we're not preempting constraints local communities can impose. The figure in Appendix A, which I've attached, highlights what a tobacco retail licensure system would look like to be an effective mechanism to enforce prevention policies in the future. Again, we're looking at meaningful fees and penalties, graduated penalties, the ability to suspend or revoke licenses, and no preemption for local governments. Currently at the Oregon Health Authority, we are disjointed in our tobacco oversight, and we are remedying this with our agency restructure, which began in February of this year and will be structurally completed on July 1 and implemented in the course of the following ensuing 9 months. Our education and prevention programs currently are within the Public Health Division, and our inspection and enforcement programs are within the Addictions and Mental Health Division, which is under the health care portion of our operations. Within our inspections program, we have 3 programs: the Federal SINAR program, the FDA program, and the State Retailer Enforcement Program, which is the only program that issues on-the-spot citations to retail clerks. I want to thank Senator Boqvist for his tenacity and focus on efficiency with regard to our enforcement programs. We are restructuring for efficiency while maintaining compliance with all federal regulations. It is our intent to do this to the maximum extent under the law, and we are confident that we both can improve our performance but also be more efficient as we go forward. The bottom line, we can't afford the status quo. Tobacco use at the current rate is detrimental to our children, to adults, and to the overall financial sustainability of our health care transformation efforts in Oregon. The Oregon Health Authority is committed to doing this work, and we look to you to give us the tools that we need to be successful. Thank you, Chair Haas, for inviting me to testify today on the importance of tobacco retail licensure. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you or the panel may have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Director. We have some questions up here. First, let me ask you a very basic question. As you know, some of the earlier iterations of this put the authority and the enforcement into the OLCC, and there was some reasons for that thinking, and now it's with you. And I guess one sort of very basic 30,000-foot level question is, can you handle it? Can your agency do this? Is there reason to believe? Can you make the case for your agency as opposed to others?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, in my 4 months at the Oregon Health Authority, one of the things that I have spent a great deal of time focusing on is the financial sustainability of the system. The single biggest determinant of our health system in Oregon is tobacco. We have put tremendous efforts in the last 90 days into looking at the current state of regulation, at the future state of regulation, and what we need to do to not only handle it but be effective going forward. And we are dedicating our resources, and both in restructuring but also the appropriate level of financial resources to achieve this goal. It is key to our very mission.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Sharon. Just for the record, I haven't read the 12s or 13s, so Ms. Saxon's ahead of me at least on the 12s. But I want to go back to the fundamental question that you asked, Mr. Chair, and Director Saxon. I've had this conversation previously, as has some of our staff. Presently, in financial stability being the key word here, because that the director raised, regardless of what we do going forward here, there are, as in a backgrounder that was provided by OHA, and I don't know if it's actually the other committee members have it, though I think I did forward it to you. And I'm just skimming through it myself. As the director pointed out, there's a SINAR program, which is the retail. There's a retail enforcement program and the tobacco FDA program. The fact that inspections work in the background information provided by OHA since October of 2014, there's been 2,633 inspections on the FDA program. The FDA program does have teeth. It does send fines out in letter format afterwards. And most of the amendments that are floating around in various forms that have this fine schedule are actually mirror images of the federal fines. I point out that since October 2014 inspection rate has a 14.85% failure rate. If you take that inspection and having done that for a year, Mr. Chair, and I'm kind of putting a lot of this on the record for the director, is then if you go from October 1 in this federal fiscal year, that rate has dropped down to just under 8%. So those inspections are having an impact and have brought the rate from 14.15% down to about 8% currently. The point here is that, as we all know, is we have DOR doing tax inspections. We have two programs at OHA. One is the SINAR program, and the other one's the Retail Enforcement Program. They, of course, have made mention of the FDA program, and on the record previously and in our files shows that OHA has actually reached out to the federal government with a proposal to take over that program. And so I guess my point here, regardless of what we're doing with these three programs at OHA, is for financial stability, there is a mechanism under federal law for the state to take over the federal FDA program and then use that data. So the consolidation of those three programs into one very successful program creates financial stability, which again, Mr. Chair, and I'd like comment from Director Saxon, is if nothing else at this point, as she says, over the last 3 or 4 months, combining this and getting one successful program going that is sustainable is absolutely critical, because if we don't do that and we continue to have three disjointed programs somewhat related to OHA and then revenue doing something else, or if we go back to the dash sevens and we add in OLCC, then we'll have five or six programs. Plus, we also learn outside of this that the Department of Justice has its own inspection program. So I'd like the director to reiterate her goal of trying to consolidate, regardless of what we do, into a single successful system.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I would like to reiterate that. There is, we're in the process right now. One of the things that I committed to the Health and Human Services Committee at the start of this work was that we would project the financial sustainability of the healthcare system for a six-year trajectory, because there have been concerns about that because of the expansion of the Affordable Care Act, among other issues. And we have now done that. And one of the things that you do when you do that kind of analysis is you identify what are the drivers, what are the most significant drivers. And as we look at all of our data going forward for Oregonians, for healthy Oregonians, it's clear tobacco is far and away the largest driver of costs for our system. I mean, it's double, triple obesity in the next two or three indicators of wellness for Oregonians. So as we looked at our own internal programs as part of our complete agency restructure, this area really popped out as one where we can consolidate. We will be using dashboard tools to track progress on a monthly basis internally. We'll have that information available to you. We need to drive hard on this effort, not only because this is critical to the well-being of Oregonians, but also the continued expenditures on tobacco and the consequences of tobacco in the healthcare system are one of the key elements that could put the whole system on its head in terms of our expenditures. So we're hard at it. I want to be clear that the restructure of the agency is effective July 1, which is the beginning of our fiscal year. It will probably take 5 to 6 months to continue the consolidations that we've begun in the last 90 days. However, during that time, we can certainly create the dashboard that will track our progress and begin to drive integration of the three programs.
And just as a follow-up, I just want to make clarity that hopefully in the future they'll be dealing with the health care committee and they will do it over there where they're supposed to do it instead of giving it to us. So I'm hoping when we're done here Director Saxton can report to them and we will be out of the tobacco business again.
Yes, we want to get back to taxes. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Saxton, first of all, you articulate very well the reasons why we should be educating about tobacco. You have me convinced it's not good, and it's not good for people to use. Got it. It's crystal clear. But I'm afraid this bill does not, you know, I think the goal of this bill is try to deter our adolescents from using tobacco. I don't see how it does that. When I look at this report given by the Oregon Healthy Teens of 2013, 53% of underage are getting their tobacco from people that are older than 18. 20% are getting their tobacco from friends. And let's see, what else? And then family members make up about 10%. This bill wouldn't help that at all. It wouldn't help that at all. And when I look at our inspections, we're at about 94% compliance. We're never going to get much better than that. I just don't see how we're ever going to get to 100%. So I don't see how this bill is going to address adolescents getting tobacco any more than it currently is today. The other part that I think is a failure in this bill is that municipalities can create their own regulations of tobacco. All as you will do with that is to create an underground community of tobacco distribution. An example, this last year in the city of New York, a man was put down police, and because of the way he was put down, he died. and that was over illegal cigarettes that he was purchasing in New Jersey and bringing to New York City. I don't want to create a black market, okay? I want to create education for the citizens so they understand the ramifications of using tobacco products. This bill does not do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Director Saxon, would you like to respond? Or I didn't hear a question there, but.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you. I appreciate the perspective you've shared. Our experience in looking at the data of other states where the retail licensure is directed at the owner of the retail operation as opposed to the clerk who's selling or perhaps making cigarettes available to youth is that it has been effective in other states. And I guess the other piece I'd just like to mention is, I don't have the benefit of the study you're citing, but when you say they are getting it from their friends, they're often getting it from friends who are purchasing it in stores and are perhaps more willing to run the risk of doing something illegal to get those cigarettes. So in our experience, licensure does have an impact on access, and I think we have to use all of the tools at our disposal, particularly because of the addictive qualities of tobacco and the implications for our youth.
This study also says that about 16.8% are getting their are buying it illegally. 16.8. But you look at, like I said, 18 years of older, 53%. More than half of the adolescents that are getting tobacco products are getting them from somebody that is old enough to buy them. This will not do anything to change that.
Thank you. Further questions of Director Lynn Saxon?
Thank you.
Senator Bubbles?
No. We've had lots of conversations.
Yes.
Thank you.
Jerry Oxley and Jim Gardner.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this morning on behalf of Fred Meyer and Safeway. After reviewing the -12 amendments to Senate Bill 663, Fred Meyer and Safeway can support the amendments as written. I've not had an opportunity to see the -13, so I'm not able to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Altria. Altria has long supported tobacco retail licensing as a tool to deter youth access. We continue to do so, and for that reason, we testify in support of the A-12s.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
13th.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, we have not seen the 13s. Our understanding is they are purely technical, but we would reserve comment on those till we actually see them.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you. I do have someone who signed up that they are more than 100 miles away. Tim Churchill.
From their lobby. Good morning. Good morning, Chair, Senator Haas, and committee. My name is Tim Churchill. I'm from Medford, Oregon, and I'm representing EC Blend. We are an e-liquid manufacturer there in Medford. We have approximately 130 employees. We do support the permitting on this as a way of deterring minors from purchasing. We would support the -9 amendment to this because of the sampling. To our industry, the sampling is a huge way that people who are looking for an alternative to smoking can adjust the flavors they want, the nicotine levels they need to if they're looking to quit smoking. There's a lot of things that, because this is a new product, they have to test. And that sampling is the only way that they can do that. So we do support the permitting, but we would like to see the dash 9 amendment. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
I have a question. You said I wasn't writing quick enough. You kind of startled me here. You have a manufacturing facility operation,
yes,
in Medford, and you said you have 130 employees?
We have approximately 130 employees. We have 5 different retail locations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
And could you just get a little more background on your company? It's the first time we've actually heard this. Actually, it's the first time anybody's ever testified in this particular arena. So I'm just a little curious. 130 employees, manufacturing. This is a little bit new to the equation.
Yeah, the whole industry is actually exploding because there's so many people looking for an alternative. Like in my case, I used the e-liquids, the e-cigarettes, to quit smoking. I smoked for over 30 years, and it was the only product. I tried all the cessation products, and that's how I actually began working for EC Blend. I enjoyed the product so much, and it was so effective for me, my personal needs, I was able to quit smoking. We do, like I said, we have 5 retail locations, and we manufacture the e-liquid, the liquid that goes in the e-cigarettes. We sell across the nation and to 14 different international countries.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Obviously, if you're international, that means you've got an export license, you're familiar in other states. What's the regulatory climate for your industry in the other states that you're operating? Do you have licensing there? Can you give us any background of your experiences there?
Where necessary, yes. The laws are, everybody's changing all kinds of different bills and regulations, but being such a new product, there's a lot of new things going on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You would still continue operating without this sampling carve out, I assume.
It would make it very difficult for the consumer to be able to have any idea what they need. There's a lot of different things that go into the e-liquid because of their makeup. There's a different nicotine levels, and aside from the different flavors, there's also the base mix that can be adjusted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate your support of the licensing concept and with the exception of this section. So on that same note, I do have some vapor people. Matt Minahan, Joseph Kilpatrick, Brian Hench, if you want to come up as a panel. And Sabrina, right?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent the Northwest Vapor Association. I'll be brief today. I'll have many members of our association testifying today that will really be focused around the importance of sampling. We are okay with the permitting piece of it. We're actually even okay with not letting minors at all in the store. As long as we get the sampling, and again, they'll talk about how important that is, we would be okay with some of these things. If the association, the Oregon Health Authority, is really concerned about the impact about tobacco and what tobacco has on our economy, they would, support the vaping industry, because it's our feeling that the vaping industry is harm reduction product. So I'll kind of end with that and let my members talk about the importance of sampling. Thank you.
Hey, how's it going today? My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I'm also a member of the Northwest Vapor Association. I'm a shop owner. I just wanted to show you this real quick. cost of a cigarette's about 20 cents these days. Kids can get those real easy. I own an adult-only vape shop where we carry these pieces of equipment. Our sole purpose of having these shops is to help people get away from tobacco. As that woman spoke earlier, the first woman, you know, talked about how, you know, the dangers of tobacco and youth getting cigarettes and, you know, our whole purpose as vape shop owners, as people into the vape industry, are very passionate about helping people quit. I know the FDA hasn't regulated anything about, you know, of these as far as being a smoking cessation device. But as far as the numbers shows, the decline of cigarette sales in the last few years, I think you guys know that it's directly correlated with the uprise of these new technologies. Cigarette smoking amongst teens is down 8% overall right now. You hear a lot of studies saying that, you know, vaporizers are being used by teens. They're up, you know, almost to, I think it's 6% right now. Well, those numbers are from zero, and it's a brand new product that people obviously, you know, parents might not be able to regulate their kids in some points, and children are going to get these products, but they're not buying them from our stores. These stores are support units where you come in. Every one of these flavors, basically, when you're smoking a cigarette for 50, 20 years, I was a 22-year smoker, there's something psychological about something that triggers your pleasure reflex. You know, something that tastes like a chocolate cream pie might be a little bit more enticing than a dirty cigarette. And so when you find these flavors that work for you, it's the key component of getting yourself off of the cigarettes. The nicotine levels, a lot of people, you know, when these products first came out, they made them with 24 milligrams of nicotine, huge amounts. So a half a pack a day smoker would buy one of these products online and be almost nauseated because they're getting a lot of nicotine. These places are educated people that are showing people how to use these products, these highly technical devices that are very, you know, expensive in contrast to a cigarette, in an adult atmosphere where you can sample these products and, like I said, go to this support unit and quit smoking cigarettes potentially with these products, as I did. It's, you know, not 100% successful for everybody, and I'm not saying that that these products are 100% safe. You know, there's people that have been making products black market, you know, so the regulation is very important, and we definitely support this bill as far as being regulated. I'm a father. I don't want this in the hands of children. I don't want kids to smoke cigarettes, but I do want to keep these places open so that we can help people quit smoking, because I feel that it's really benefiting. And if you look at the numbers recently with the rise of vaping versus, you know, the decline of cigarette sales, I think it's obvious. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Chair Haas and committee, my name is Sabrina Wright. I own a shop in Kaiser. We are a family-owned small shop, and we do have taste testing, which helps our customers that come in who don't know what flavor they might want or the nicotine level that they have, you know, that they need. We do a lot of talking with them and working them through. I've helped literally less than a year open, and I've already helped hundreds of people quit smoking, myself and my husband included. We saved $250 to $300 a month when we quit smoking, plus we saved our health. I smoked 30 years. I'm asthmatic. I used to use my inhaler all the time. I got bronchitis every time I got sick. I have used my inhaler once this last year. And I had a normal cold for once. It's amazing what this stuff does, and to take this away could really hurt people who are trying to quit. I'm totally for the registration, the licensing.
The measures and taking anything away.
The tasting. It's very vital that we get the correct measurements of nicotine and the flavor that these people want, because without it, they're going to go online. And you're going to, small businesses will suffer. Small businesses like me will suffer. We make our own e-liquid in store in a lab, and our business would suffer, because if they can't taste test and they can get it cheaper online, why get it from us? Because they can't taste either one.
Can I say something?
Any questions of these three?
No, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll call the gentleman up in the front row.
Thank you.
morning, Senator Haas, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Hench. I'm a part owner in a vape store. As a matter of fact, the lady that you just heard from is my daughter, Sabrina. My daughter and her husband, James, quit smoking cigarettes on Mother's Day a year ago. And I hadn't even heard of vaping at that point. I had no idea what this was all about. So I started doing a little looking into it, a little research, and I suddenly discovered that this was a viable alternative to cigarette smoking. Not only was it a viable alternative, but the health benefits of quitting smoking were almost immediately realized by those who started vaping instead. Their sense of taste came back. Their sense of smell came back. They started feeling better. They stopped smelling, as we all know is a problem. One of the things that helped them quit smoking was the ability to choose a variety of flavors that they could vape and enjoy. I'm afraid that if the people who come into the shop today are not allowed to experiment with some of the flavors that are available, and in our particular shop we have 150 different flavors that are mixed in together to make approximately 70 different possible flavors. But we don't label ours like candy. Our shop has a screen over all of the windows. You cannot see inside of it during the daytime at all. We do not allow children 18 years. Anybody under 18 is not even allowed in our store. And we have always had an emphasis on not trying to bring in new vapers who are not smokers. I don't want to see children come in and start trying vaping products or start vaping because they can't get cigarettes or because they think it looks cool. I think that the only reason that we opened was to help people stop smoking. And we've been highly successful at that. I have personally had three different people come in on different occasions who told me their doctors sent them. I think that's a real indication of how doctors are looking at vaping now, because it's helping these people who are completely addicted to their cigarettes and whose health is suffering greatly. I don't have a problem with licensing, but I don't think that taking the flavors out is going to help these people quit smoking. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, I do. I have a few, maybe a sort of summation of your sure. presentation, and that is the goal here isn't, you know, just to shift people from one form of tobacco to another. And what I heard was people quitting cigarettes to go to vaping. But I think one of the concerns of public health officials and the Oregon Health Authority is to stop tobacco use, period, among minors, not just to go from one medium to another, if you will.
Sure, I understand that. And what I was saying is we don't sell to children. We don't market to children. We have no interest in their business. We market specifically to adults who are current smokers who would like to be ex-smokers. So this is why we have a sign posted on the front door. No one's allowed in the shop who isn't 18 or older, period. We card everyone who looks younger than my daughter, who's somewhere near 40. And the reason that we do that is because we don't want to sell to children. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I'm just kind of struggling. I see your point.
Okay.
I sometimes go into wine shops. Mm-hmm. You have 150 flavors. Wine shops have many more than that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it would help customers sometimes if they could say, well, can I just do a little sample here or there? That's not permitted. So I'm just trying to justify and reconcile different points of view. Why would it be okay in a vape shop and not in a wine store?
If you go to a winery, I do believe they do allow tasting. So I don't know. Are they breaking the law? The reason that we allow a taste testing is because one flavor will not work for another person.
Yeah.
And that's the main reason. I'm struggling a little bit with trying to understand the concept of not allowing them to taste, not allowing them to test within the premises of the shop, and giving them an opportunity to find something that they'll enjoy that'll help them quit smoking. So children are not going to get that product from us at all. They can't even see it being used in our shop at all. So we're trying our best to make an environment that allows people to make a decision about how they're going to quit smoking, and giving them a variety of options in order to help them along that path. Now, as far as the flavors, and because we do have our own lab, we've asked them, how much are you smoking? And then we try to tailor the liquid to their nicotine addiction need. But what we find is they come back in a few weeks and they say, I'd like to drop that. And so they may start at 18, but within 5 or 6 months, they're often down to 6 or 3 milligrams of nicotine per milliliter. And that's an important advancement. And we've even had some people who have just literally quit. And I don't mind losing customers that way, because there's an awful lot of people out there who are addicted to smoking.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
How about Mel Rader, Morgan Cowling, and Tim Schultz?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the Executive Director of Upstream Public Health. We've testified a few different times on this bill already, and I think it's very important we address the issue around illegal of sales to minors, and believe a licensing system is an important step. I want to provide comments on the Dash 12 amendments. I have not read the Dash 13 at this point. And I think the critical piece here is, what is the relationship with state government and county government in implementing this program? And I want to say that the system is most effective when they are coordinated. There is a strong component around education and training of retailers. And there's a clear, understandable system for step up in consequences of sales to minors. I think the Dash 12s, there's a number of things that are improvements over previous versions, but I want to say, put on the record, that I'm very concerned around the some of the preemption language, particularly the one on page 2, lines 1 through 4, that says local governments cannot pass an ordinance restricting the processes of licensing system. I find this I am concerned that it's imprecise language. We aren't sure what the full consequences of that language will be. Having imprecise language by itself opens it up to more legal challenges. But in addition, it potentially might restrict the ability of counties to have strong enforcement systems that are coordinated with the state enforcement system, and I think that's a really critical component of this legislation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Morgan Cowling with the Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing the 34 public health departments throughout Oregon. First, I want to thank the committee for your work on this important issue to protect children and protect the community. We definitely think, in terms of the Dash 12 amendments, that they're a step in the right direction. They make some great improvements from the Dash 8 amendments that I think last week or the week before I was here speaking with you. So we really like in the Dash 12 the continuing partnership between OHA and the Department of Revenue for the oversight of this program. We are in strong support of removing the sampling exemption for vape shops. We think that is very important. As I've mentioned, we have several jurisdictions throughout Oregon that do not allow sampling in vape shops, and we think that that should be the gold standard that we have across the state. Removing that sampling exemption will protect workers in the businesses. They will protect attached businesses, business workers, and clients in those attached businesses from the secondhand vape. So we are very appreciative of that change in this amendment. We also support the inclusion of inspection enforcement of local laws and appreciate, again, that work. The two things that we do still have some questions about, as Mel mentioned, the preemption language, we just need a little bit more time to fully understand exactly what that's doing. And while we got the amendment on Friday, have not been able to get clarity to exactly what that is doing. The language does seem a little vague. The other piece, as Mel mentioned, local governments can be an effective tool for training and enforcement of these retail laws, and we want to make sure that using counties and local governments for that body of work is allowed under this, and we have not been able to get confirmation that it is. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions, and thank you for your work on this.
Hi, my name is Tim Schultz, and I live and work in District 14 in Beaverton. I run a vape shop in downtown Central Beaverton. Mention I work there, and I run there is I don't own the shop. I got into this business to help people stop smoking. I was a server engineer. Used to work IT and manage servers all over the country for Albertsons. Got in this to help people quit smoking. Bring up some of your questions, Chairman. You talked about trading one for the other. This isn't tobacco. It contains nicotine, which can come from tobacco, but to consider them the same thing, I think is it harms our health in the long term. To think that the vaporizing of a liquid is the same as actually combusting stuff and that the harm is equivalent, I think is kind of absurd. I know there are some studies here and there, and I think when the truth finally comes down, eventually everybody will be thanking the industry if we're allowed to stick around. As far as the sampling goes, you talked about sampling wine. Currently, growler shops, you go into a growler shop, they have 40, 50, 60 kegs sometimes. You are absolutely allowed to sample every single one of those. And they're not required to serve food like a bar normally would either. So I think there's definitely some precedence for an adult-type substance with the sampling like that. It is very, very important. I don't even sample nicotine in my shop at all, but the flavor is very important. I also sell a lot of crafts-type liquids. When my customers come in, I refer to them as the microbrews. They're little limited runs. They're craft-type stuff. Same thing that you would find like in a growler-type shop. That's where I market to. And it would absolutely kill my business to lose that type of sampling. I'd pack up and go. It'd be gone.
Questions? Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So given the data, we know that we're in compliance in the state of Oregon, somewhere around 94% on selling to adolescents. We also know that more than 50% of the access to tobacco products to adolescents are from people that are old enough to buy it. How would this bill help us change the way adolescents get tobacco products?
Is this the Ms. Kelly?
Is any other?
Chair Haas, members of the committee. I think this is one piece of the puzzle. I don't think anybody would say this will solve the problem. I think as has been mentioned, there's different data sources. The FDA, which is a newer data source, shows a lower rate versus SINAR shows Oregon has the highest rate in the country. I would also mention, regardless of whether the what the real rate is. The not being having such a high rate through the signer data has potential consequences for the state. And according to the signer amendment by the federal government, if it's a state is over 20%, it can jeopardize state fundings. Oregon was 22%, the only state over 20%. But because of the margin of error that fell below 20%, that provision was not triggered, which would have potentially led $9 million of state funds from being jeopardized. That's a really important concern in itself. In terms of what will this do, this will restrict sales directly to minors through an enforcement system, which is one critical piece of the puzzle. It also sets a precedent for being more concerned generally around sales and use to minors. It also educates retailers. A good system will educate them, tell them about the rules, tell them about counseling and discussion with clients around the risks of youth tobacco use. So it's a multiple step process, but another key component is going to be the tobacco prevention and education program and other programs that will bring that rate down.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Just for the record, and I don't need a response because I'm about to blow a gasket, and when I do, as a vice chair, I'll put the next witness under oath. I continue to hear this rhetoric about the SINAR amendment and the state of Oregon and how great its inspection program is. The SINAR inspection did about 1,200 inspections according to the records that we have. Of those, the final report pulled out 383 or just under 400 to come up with the documentation. As the director said, there are some problems within Oregon Health Authority that need to be corrected. If this is the committee in which we're going to bring it up, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to put people under oath and start dragging out all of the accurate information. I would just advise everybody, if you're going to use information that we know is not accurate, that needs to be fixed, which we're all in favor of fixing, let's not keep going back and rehashing SINAR stuff that is faulty. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Justin Rainey, Richard Kosasan.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Justin Rainey, I'm here today on behalf of 7-Eleven stores. 7-Eleven stores, we have not had an opportunity to review the Dash 13 amendments, but we have looked briefly at the Dash 12 amendments. We're here today in opposition to the Dash 12 amendments and would likely be in opposition to the Dash 13 amendments, assuming they were just technical changes. Our concerns with the bill are very similar to the concerns we testified regarding the Dash 8 amendments. We have significant concerns with the agency setting the licensure standards by rule. This provides no certainty for our businesses or for our stores. We don't know what that looks like. We'd much rather see the legislature put some guidelines in statute that we can all work with. as you read the bill, there's no certainty for what a renewal of a license might be. We don't know what that's going to look like through the rulemaking process. Again, we think this is something where stores and stakeholders should be at the table trying to talk about what works for them and what they're currently doing within the stores that they see could be best practices. But we were not involved in any sort of a work group. Furthermore, Section 2, regarding the preemption language, we're very concerned that this language does not provide strong preemption language that would prevent a patchwork approach to regulating the sale of tobacco products. The bill fails to give stores any certainty from county to county as to what the rules are going to be would be around. It's very unclear what would happen with couponing, marketing, or advertising that stores do. For us, it's important that it's consistent from county to county, so that as we go in from the corporate, we can make sure that each store is located in different counties. They have the same information and are doing the same thing.
Could I
stop
you just on that point? What would stop them now without a licensing bill from doing all of those things?
Chair, at this point, there is no preemption, to my knowledge.
That's right. So how would this be worse than current law?
Well, I mean, I think we're just looking for clarification. And what the point is, we'd rather see a state standard. So if we're going to do preemption language, what we'd like to see is a stronger preemption that precludes counties from going and doing this. So, you know, really for us, it's more of a we don't believe in the patchwork approach. And the same with the taxes, especially around an inhalant delivery system. This preemption language does not give any certainty or assurances that counties can't go set up their own tax around an e-cigarette. Which would be incredibly problematic for a lot of our stores based on the different counties. So we have significant concerns with Section 2 and the way it's currently drafted. We also have concerns giving both agencies enforcement. We think this is something that the Department of Revenue can do through contracts with the FDA. We don't think we need to have two agencies duplicating the work. I mean, we really believe that stronger retail training and education and awareness of the problems associated with youth tobacco is really what's going to help us end or decline the purchase of tobacco by minors. So we think that should be the approach the state pursues. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosasan, thank you very much. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which predominantly is engaged with the representation of small convenience stores. I distributed a piece from the FDA, determination of the period covered by a non-tobacco sale order in compliance with an order, and this is looking for draft guidance. This was published in the Federal Register on May 13th. This is a result in part and predominantly as a result of the 2009 Federal Tobacco Control Act. And we've heard a lot of discussion about FDA inspections to date in this last calendar year, 14 and 15, I believe the FDA has conducted slightly over 2,600 inspections. But this request for comments are due at the end of June, for this draft guidance would forward FDA direction in terms of going to a retailer and stopping all tobacco sales. I would argue pretty strongly that if FDA does 2,600 inspections, now they go down the road of, if we have a problem, stopping complete tobacco sales, that would for all intents and purposes, take care of a need for a licensing requirement. Again, that's for information, but I would encourage people to look at what FDA does, what they have been doing, and I would strongly encourage the committee and the state to look at available resources through the FDA to enhance random inspections of retailers to make certain that the responsible retailer is not selling tobacco to minors. And with that, I think it's worthy to note, I believe the vast majority of retailers in the marketplace try and strive very diligently to make certain that tobacco is not distributed or sold to minors. With respect to the proposed amendments, Mr. Chair, I would agree with the gentleman from Upstream Public Health. He indicated that the language contained in Section 2 lacks clarity, and I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I believe Mr. Rainey is right on target. We have, with respect to tobacco taxation, a very clear and clean-cut, well-delineated definition of preemption. And basically you're saying that the state is the functioning unit for the taxation of tobacco, and that is in lieu of local government further regulation and further taxation. I think that should be looked at. The amendments, I think, fail in one regard to direct the state to look at the coordination of inspections. We have FDA doing inspections. We have the health authority doing inspections. We have Department of Revenue doing inspections for purposes of tax compliance. I believe we would be much more effective and efficient if we developed some amendments to coordinate those inspections. I would also encourage the committee to take a look in terms of inspections at language contained in ORS 431-853. And that language, I believe, was incorporated into statutory framework in 2012. Basically, you're saying you're going to inspect a retailer once a month unless you have a compliance problem, which makes sense. A retailer, I don't think, should face an inspection today by Department of Revenue, tomorrow by FDA, the next day by OHA, and the next day by OHA, and the next day by a local. If a compliance problem exists, as the feds are looking at now, prohibit the sale of tobacco products. But to require a license, to me, it is a built-in assumption and a very major assumption that a licensing framework will reduce the prevalence of youth and tobacco use. With that, Mr. Chair, I would take a look at the fiscal associated with House Bill. I believe it was 3534, and in terms of a licensing payment, I think that suggested initial payment of about $300 per license. For some small retailers, perhaps with multiple outlets, that's a fairly sizable financial obligation. I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions?
I have Senator one short technical question. The association you represent are all small retailers. What's the average size of those retailers in comparison to a Fred Meyer or Safeway?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, we are much smaller than a Fred Meyer or a Safeway. I would suspect the average convenience store square footage is 2,000 to 2,500 square feet. But these would reflect a Jackson's, a Plaid Pantry, a Dairy Mart, a Leather's Fuel, just to name a few. But they're all relatively very small retail operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No questions. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 663. We are not going to take action or vote on it today. Thank you to the stakeholders for moving toward consensus. We have one bit of business before our committee here today, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 2566A. We heard last week on disaster aid. All right. Yes, we're just in a work session here, so I do want to give us a quick reminder.
I think you have to do a public hearing. You haven't done a public hearing.
I'm sorry. I'm getting my bells. We're opening up a public hearing and work session on 2566A. Go ahead and give us that.
Leave me astray. I was ready to make a motion.
Yes.
I'm already in trouble with everybody.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2566 would provide that disaster or emergency-related work conducted by an out-of-state business may not be the only reason for determining that the company is doing business in Oregon. That's a corporate excise tax issue. And by that not being the sole reason, they would not be subject to Oregon's income tax. Similarly, out-of-state employees working in Oregon for disaster or emergency-related work would not be subject to the personal income tax. Basically, in response to emergencies or natural disasters, any businesses or people coming into work in Oregon for purposes of helping the state recover from those disasters would not then be subject to income tax laws.
Okay. John Powell, George Granger, Mike Dewey.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing AT&T. I'm joined by George Granger, president of AT&T Oregon, in support of House Bill 2566. Very briefly, this bill was heard originally in the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, where it moved out unanimously to the House Revenue Committee, where it moved out unanimously to the House floor, where it passed unanimously last week. The genesis of the bill goes back to 9/11, Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, and lessons learned about critical infrastructure response to major disasters. And while this bill is not exactly the same, it's based on and is similar to an NCSL model bill dealing with disaster relief. And the basics behind the bill include that if the President of the United States or the Governor of Oregon declare a major disaster or major emergency, critical infrastructure companies, at the invitation of an Oregon-registered critical infrastructure company, can bring employees from outside the state of Oregon or contractors from outside of the state of Oregon to perform disaster relief work for a limited period of time without having to file and withhold Oregon State income tax or register for certain licenses to bring equipment or people into the state during that period. This has a negligible effect on AT&T, the company, but it does assist AT&T employees who, in these situations, end up having to file multiple W-2s, have their FICA withholding restarted, sometimes having to transfer an employee from, for example, AT&T Ohio into the AT&T Oregon corporate structure, and these things cause delays in getting employees into the state. With that, I'll pass it off to George to add anything that I may have missed.
Thank you, Senator Haas, and members of the committee. I think John did a terrific job really outlining the bill, and it's a bill that is passing all over the country because of the sense of urgency about about being responsive to a natural disaster. And I'm sorry, I don't know where that's coming from. I'm so excited to tell you about this bill, obviously. But at any rate, this bill is passing around the country. 17 states have already passed the legislation. And while AT&T is taking the lead on this here in Oregon, I can tell you this would apply to any company that has critical infrastructure where their employees are coming in from another state in order to restore that service as quickly as possible. It does a couple things. One, it makes sure that public safety it gets back online as quickly as possible, and it contributes to the economy of the state. The sooner that we get the critical infrastructure back up and running, the more quickly the state can resume normal operations. And so we'd be happy to answer any questions. We had a great work in the House of Representatives. We appreciated the work of Representative Lively and Representative Barnhart in working through this bill and so that we could ultimately bring it to you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, on behalf of the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association members. We commend AT&T for bringing this bill forward. I've been to a number of conferences where we've talked about critical infrastructure and how to get the people and the equipment to that area as quick as possible. And what we like about the bill is for Oregon companies, Comcast, Charter, for example, large cable companies, they operate in Washington, Idaho, and California. So we have people that we can get here and contractors very quickly to Oregon. And what's nice about it is we don't have to ask, what do we have to do? we can just go ahead and get this done as quickly as possible, because this is critical infrastructure. This is information that is important to Oregonians. So we do urge your passage of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel of witnesses? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are in a work session, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2566A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2566 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. The measure passes.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Well, I have Senator Bartsugger beat you to
go
it.
Ahead. Oh, well, Senator Bartsugger is more than welcome to.
He volunteered.
I was trying to save my colleague.
Yeah.
But okay. If he doesn't want it saved today, then me. I am happy
I'm
to throw him
right.
under
so
the
Senator
bus.
Senator Bartsugger will carry it. And thank you all. We will adjourn.